Movie BS with Aaron Snyder.
Jeff and Eric were walking through the woods one night. That's right. When they saw something giving off an eerie light, so bright. Turned out it was an alien meteorite. That's right. And its radiation gave them superhuman insight. So bright.
And on that day, they vowed to use their powers for good instead of evil, swearing to protect mankind from the vile clutches of their evil arch-nemesis, Bad Cinema. And if you find yourself in a bind at the multiplex, not sure what to watch, you too can call on
Movie BS with Aaron Snyder.
Hello and welcome to Movie BS with Aaron Snyder. Reporting live from the streets of Austin, Texas.
From the hallway of a movie theater.
I am Jeff Baer. Along with me, as always, my co-host, Eric D. Snyder.
Hi, I'm Eric D. Snyder. It's my co-host, Jeff Baer. We're here at Fantastic Fest. It's the last day of Fantastic Fest.
8 days.
It's been 8 very full days.
Yeah.
Very 8 days rich with life and
I
passion.
Believe when it's all said and done, I'll have seen 27 or 28 films.
I think
that's
it. I stopped counting after 80.
Wow, you're really doing it, Eric. Look at you go.
And it's actually just because I can't count higher than 80.
And you've actually only seen 2 movies.
Yeah, it's just, that's where I cut off.
Once you get started counting, you can't stop.
Nope. So we're going to talk all about our Fantastic Fest movies today.
Yeah. This is the kind of podcast where you get your pencil and your notebook out, mm-hmm. and you jot down a couple of titles, because it could be until spring until you see some of this stuff. Or it's like, wait, what was that movie from 7 years ago? It's on video on demand now. I can see it.
You'll make notes of the things you're thinking, I want to check that out later.
Mm-hmm.
First up is an obscure indie film that they managed to get at Fantastic Fest, or they managed to get into Fantastic Fest.
That's right.
So good for them, upcoming filmmakers. It's called The Martian.
This Ridley Scott fellow?
Scott, yeah. Yeah.
Ridley, yep, I'm saying that correct.
He's going places.
Matt Damon.
I believe it's Damon.
Damon.
He's French. The Martian opens everywhere this weekend. It also had a screening here at Fantastic Fest, so technically it counts.
That's right. And you were lucky enough to see it beforehand. Before the festival.
I did, I saw it. Yeah.
But I caught it here, and goodness gracious, what a film.
When you saw it here, it was in 3D, I assume.
Yes.
But it was here at the Draft House, so it was not IMAX. It wasn't
it was not IMAX
screen, but yeah.
But I have to say, I had no problem sitting through this 3D.
I enjoyed this 3D, and you know my feelings about 3D.
You dislike
I hate it.
All 3D,
I
so
hate
explain
it.
Yourself,
And I hate
sir.
People who like it.
Right. So how did you didn't mind this 3D? Because
I didn't.
It was all about like natural depth, maybe?
Yeah, I right from the beginning, they were in a dust storm.
Mm-hmm.
Dust storm, I guess, on Mars. Mars is a dusty place.
Oh, it's
very
terrible.
Dusty. And I noticed the effect of the dust and how it made me feel like, oh, I'm in this deep storm. And
me too,
me
too.
It didn't bother
me.
It didn't give me a headache. I was it was unobtrusive.
Yeah.
There was nothing like, no obvious 3D, like, oh, I'm going to point this stick at you or whatever.
Right.
So I thought it was a good immersive use of 3D.
Right. I did too, and I didn't see it on a giant screen. I saw it on a good size screen, but it wasn't the biggest possible.
Yeah, yeah.
It would have been nice to see it on the biggest possible because it's a very pretty movie.
It is.
Here's the deal. Here's the deal, people. There's a group. They're hanging out on Mars like you do.
Group of astronauts.
Yeah.
Not just some guys.
Right. And, storm's moving in.
Mm-hmm.
We got to get to the ship. This one could be worse than usual.
We got to leave Mars.
Right. And they try to work as a team and get back. But Matt Damon, also known in this one, what is his? It's Mark Watney.
Mark Watney.
He doesn't make it back.
Well, they think he's dead.
Yeah.
Leave without him.
Right.
Long story short, he's now on Mars by himself.
That's right.
And he's super bored. Like, all the stores are closed. Because it's not the tourist season.
Yeah.
It's the off-season.
That's right. It is the off-season. The off-season for quite a while.
Millions of years.
I guess from, I don't know, if you listen to science, it takes a long time to get to Mars. And this movie listens to so much science. It is lovely. Honestly, it is dramatic science porn.
Here is the thing. And you didn't read the book, right?
I did not read the book. I just now heard the story of how this book even came to be, which is awesome as well.
The book is even more science-y. The book is Nirvana for science nerds.
Yeah. I think this movie is my level of science.
Yeah.
My level of science is, okay, I'm not quite sure exactly what term you just used, but you look like you know what you're doing.
I'm going to take your word for it.
And my eye test checks out. I believe you. Let's continue now.
And the book does a very good... Basically, everything that's in the movie, the book, is also in the book, but explained in even more detail.
Okay.
And sometimes in the book, my eyes would start to glaze over. I'd be right. Like, okay, I'm just going to take your word for this. Like, probably if I had recently taken 10th grade chemistry, I would remember some of this, but I haven't done it recently, so I don't know.
Is the... playful nature.
Yes,
it's in the book.
The book. Everything that's funny in the movie is in the book.
Wonderful.
Yeah,
because that is so necessary in this movie. Because otherwise, you would feel stuck. You would feel stuck with Matt Damon. You would feel stuck in space. Whatever you want to say, but like,
see, because here's what happens to him. He's stuck on Mars, and unlike you or me or any normal person, where we'd be like, "Oh, I'm gonna die on Mars now."
Mm-hmm.
He's like, well, I guess I better. He knows that the earliest will be like 4 years before they can get back to find him,
right.
If they even know that he's still alive. And so he has to find a way to make his food last 4 years. And again, you or I right there, he's like, oh, well, I guess I'm dead then.
But guess what he is?
He's a scientist and a botanist.
He's a botanist.
And he's an optimist. That's the most important ist that he is.
He is an incredible optimist because, actually, you know what? One person already asked me, ugh, am I going to feel dread in this movie?
Right.
And you don't. In fact, it is 100% the opposite of that. You feel hope.
Yeah.
You feel there's so many times where I will feel jaded. I will feel jaded about somebody climbing Mount Everest and running into trouble and just be like, look at all the extent that we have to go to rescue an individual that
this idiot.
Yes. I wanted this man rescued so bad.
And
you get so hooked on the hope that he is bringing other scientists in the film.
He's very resourceful.
Yes.
So he has a very can-do. It's a very American movie. The American spirit of optimism and problem solving. Here's a situation, and he says, all right, this problem seems impossible to solve. I'm going to figure out a way to solve it. And we feel like, yeah, we're going to solve this, but we don't know how he's going to do it. But somehow we're going to get this guy off of Mars.
And what I love is it moves beyond the American can-do.
They bring in, yeah.
It does. And not only that, we've talked about Matt Damon quite a bit. There's a dozen familiar actors in this movie.
Yeah.
And it had the opposite effect that Everest did for me. It made it much better to see Kristen Wiig or Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Jessica Chastain.
Or Jessica Chastain interact, or Michael Pena interact in all these situations. Whereas in Everest, it felt like stunt casting.
Right.
Here, it feels like camaraderie for a higher purpose or something really weird. But this is one of those movies where, like, intelligent people should be really happy it exists, and the people that want to feel something in a theater, just like that feeling of hope, they should be happy it exists too.
It's a very optimistic movie, and like you said, very funny. Got some exciting stuff. Even though we feel pretty confident, Matt Damon is not going to die.
I wouldn't necessarily say that.
Exciting stuff.
I wouldn't say that.
I guess I was confident because I had read the book.
There you go.
Yeah, it's really, really good times and funny. And like you said, you worried that it'll be oppressive because he's stranded alone. If anything, the movie and the book, too, underplays the loneliness and the despair that would be part of it.
Yeah.
Glosses over it, which is fine. That's an intentional choice because this is going to focus more on the positive. Like, yeah, I was alone for years and it was rough, but never mind. We're solving problems here. And I think that's...
Did you notice how the press and media played a role in this film?
Mm-hmm.
It was,
yeah, because NASA keeps reporting on what's going on.
It was one of positive, like, sharing of information.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was like, well, we need to... Like,
the whole world is rallied together.
Right. This is going to get out. We need to talk about this. Or, like, let's do this, like, let's have this be a live feed so we all find out at the same time. And, like, things like that where it was just like... Yeah, I like your future, Ridley Scott.
Also unrealistic.
Terribly.
Nobody in the press, in the movie, ever really brings up the issue of, so how many billions of dollars are we spending rescue one guy?
I think they figured that out. The billions thing?
Yeah.
Like, it's not an issue.
It's not
in the future. No, they figured
it out. Oh, money's not an issue in the future?
I don't think so. Otherwise, they would have brought it up.
I'm just saying, in real life.
Yeah.
Like, let's bring our astronauts home, but also.
And not only that, they saw how important it was to save Matt Damon during World War II.
Save Ryan, yeah.
So then they were just like, well, it's worth it. Good things will happen if we save this guy.
This guy is he's more trouble than he's worth, I might say. See, I give it an A-.
It's a 9 out of 10.
Perfectly lovely film. And that means it's BS approved.
Feels like it's been a while.
It hasn't. It's been like 2 weeks.
Oof, that
long. Sleeping with other people.
No, thank you.
At which point you also said, it feels like it's been a while. But at that point, it had been a while.
Oh, I am entertaining.
What'd you say, 9 or 8?
9.
All right, then. That's The Martian. And now on to other Fantastic Fest movies that we've both seen. We're gonna stick to the ones we both saw, then we'll kind of do some others that we only
and maybe a little rapid fire
briefly.
Stuff
yeah.
that one
yeah.
didn't see and the other did.
Next, let's do The Keeping Room. Couldn't read my own writing.
The Keeping Room.
Keeping Room, which I believe is now actually in theaters.
Oh, that's right.
It opened kind of. They showed it to us last Thursday night, and then it opened in some places on Friday. I think it's on video on demand.
All right, who do we got in? We got Britt Marlin.
Haley Steinfeld,
who you guys might remember from True Grit, and now she's finally in things again.
She's doing some stuff, yeah.
Doing some stuff.
She was just in something else, too. She was in Pitch Perfect, too.
Is the African-American actress, is she new on the scene? I did not feel like I was familiar with her.
In The Keeping Room?
Yes.
Yeah, I am not familiar with Muna Otaru.
So here's what we got here, people.
Hmm.
1865.
Yeah.
It's the American South.
Mm-hmm.
The men are off to war.
Right. They're fighting that civil war they got
right.
going on down there.
And the women are home alone. Fending for themselves.
Shenanigans. You leave those gals alone, boy.
Haley, the young one, has a little, she's got a little smart mouth on her in the
mm-hmm.
beginning.
Mm-hmm.
She
mm-hmm.
doesn't feel like she should have to be doing all
couple
this
couple of slaves. It's
work.
Louise, right. Louise and Augusta. And they've got their slave, whose name is Mad. That's Muna Otaru. And Haley Steinfeld, yeah, still kind of... we gather the war is still going on, so slavery is not ended, but they kind of... the handwriting's on the
yeah.
wall.
Right.
They know that it's on its way out. And
right.
as Augusta points out, because of the situation, we're all N-words.
That's right.
Right now.
And Britt Marlin does a lovely job here of once again bringing a powerful woman to the screen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There are lovely speeches here. My main problem is with the boys here, they are evil personified,
mm-hmm.
and that is their one note. They are evil, and they're a-coming.
Yeah.
And so it's just that thing of, like, you know that eventually we're getting to a home invasion.
Mm-hmm.
And what are these guys like? Well, they like raping.
They do. And the movie gets into a little bit of, aside from that aspect of it, the fact of women being alone and sort of being sexually lonely and
mm-hmm.
all the men are gone.
Yes.
And so that's an issue. But it's really sort of the basic home invasion thriller moved to the South in 1865.
Right.
Which is, you know, a new setting is fine. Varies up a little bit, but it is still a pretty familiar formula.
It is. And, again, a couple of speeches, very nice. And you get the feeling that you're there, except it's Sam Worthington as...
I guess, as, yeah, one of the Yankee soldiers.
One of the Yankee soldiers. And it's... oh, man. It hints occasionally at what it's really trying to be, in my opinion. But otherwise, it's by the books.
Yeah.
It's a 6 out of 10.
It's a B-.
Yeah.
And then Anomalisa.
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 Anomaly.
Anomaly.
Lisa.
Lisa.
Anomalisa.
Yeah. Not Animalisa.
No.
We, at first we were saying Animalisa, but it's Anomalisa.
Anomalisa.
And this is written and directed by Charlie Kaufman, co-directed by Charlie Kaufman.
And Duke Johnson.
I don't know who that is. That sounds like a made-up name.
It does.
And it's Charlie Kaufman, of course, is the weirdo who wrote, who made an adaptation, An Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. He wrote that.
Yeah.
And
he's directed some oddities.
Synecdoche, New York.
Yeah.
He's an odd man.
Uh-huh.
He's odd in a way that speaks to many people. And here, this movie is stop-motion animation made with little models, little puppets.
That's right. And
pretty realistic, human-looking I mean, they make them look like real people as much as you can.
They do. What they don't do is they don't remove, like, most stop-motion figures have, like, a line going from, like, say, the ear to the nose.
So they can move the faces and put different facial expressions on. Yeah.
They don't remove that because they felt like that was going to be not as authentic.
Right.
And it's an interesting thing because for a while, you're just trying to make sense of this world that you're in. You don't exactly know what's going
on. You wonder if maybe these people's faces come off or something. Right. Or if they're robots.
You wonder if this is part of a world that you're going to see bigger. Right. But what you realize is you are in one journey with a man, and it is very mundane besides these wonderful visuals. And then these moments that really, truly, and utterly stand out, and you're surprised, like I was surprised at how into it I could be at times, even though at other times I was like, all right, I'm just going to sit back and wait for the next thing, I guess, to happen.
It's very engrossing. David Thewlis is the voice of the main guy, Michael Stone, and he's on a business trip in Cincinnati, hotel room. We get that he's lonely. He's got a wife back home. We notice that, for some reason, all the characters have male voices.
Yes.
Even the females. And that's a weird choice at first. Okay. And then that comes into play.
Right.
And at first I was thinking about why is this movie animated? Or why is it stop motion animated instead of live action? And the voice thing, okay, that's a little easier then, but
yes,
why else?
True.
And then I came to see, oh, this makes sense. This is, and apparently the way they originally did it was as just like a live reading of just a sound, like a radio thing, where they had sound effects and stuff. And so it's meant to be, it kind of has to exist in an imaginary world, either just in your ears or we'll use some puppets to enact it. It wouldn't work live action with regular actors.
And it is about relationships. It's about interacting.
He meets a woman named Lisa, who he likes. Jennifer Jason Leigh.
And it's very intimate feeling. And then what you realize is you have to bring a little of yourself into it to fully get engrossed in this film. And then it's simply a matter of, okay, what is it? How do you feel about it? What does it mean to you?
Yeah.
What do you think this connected as? And I think I fully understand it from my perspective. And I walked away being really happy with the feeling of seeing it.
Yeah.
And it's that weird thing of, like, I wonder if I go back to this movie or if I just want that taste of it to remain. Yeah, like, I don't know. I don't know yet.
It's sad. It's a sad,
melancholy
kind of movie. It's really funny sometimes.
Feels much longer than the hour and a half than it is.
It has a lot of mundane dialogue, like sort of the mundane aspects of taking a taxi to the hotel and checking in and all that stuff. So we feel like we're moving into this guy's state of mind.
Right.
And it does kind of stick with you and feels kind of depressed.
Yeah.
And kind of a lot of things. I want to see it again. But I like it. But his movies are so weird sometimes. And
they are
kind
very
of
weird.
Hard to
this is definitely more
find a way on.
More weird. But yeah, so far, it's an 8 out of 10 for me.
Yeah, B+.
Oh, it's BS approved. Whatever.
Men and Chicken. This is from Danish weirdo Anders Thomas Jensen and his Danish weirdo friend Mads Mikkelsen.
What has he made?
He made a film called Adam's Apples about 10 years ago, which I didn't see but was well-liked.
Men and Chicken is going to give people a different look at Mads.
Mm-hmm.
If they were in love with him from Hannibal because he's beautiful, this...
Which is not really. He has fish lips.
Okay.
I don't get it. I don't get the appeal, but I...
But it's out there, right?
It's out there. Many people find him attractive.
This is... Goodness.
This time he's got a hair lip and a very unflattering haircut and...
All right, so the idea with this movie is two brothers discover... They have a larger family.
Discover they have more. The two, half brothers, discover that they have three more half brothers. That their father, man, they thought their father was not their father, and he has fathered some other children, and they've all got some things in common.
And they're all some sort of level of gross or insane or deviant,
violent. They've got hair lips, and they live out on a sort of Island of Dr. Moreau situation. Small island off Denmark.
I really enjoyed it.
it's really funny. To me, it kind of overdoes sometimes trying to be taboo.
Okay.
I'll tell you what I mean. The Mads Mikkelsen character, Elias, he is a compulsive masturbator.
Yes.
He'll run off, like, every couple hours, got to go off and do
it's
that.
It's not his fault.
Sure, whatever. That's fine, but, like, it never plays into the story at all. It's sort of a thing early on, and then it's gone for most of the way until we see it, like, once again near the end.
Okay.
But it's just sort of it establishes kind of a character thing, but then it's also... But what point does that serve?
Well, it's an eventual tell.
Yeah.
It does. It does eventually play a role. That's the thing where it's definitely not a movie that you should bother sitting back and trying to figure things out. Just allow the insanity to wash over you, and then I think it sticks the ending quite a bit. It's like an odd fairy tale.
They go and they meet their half brothers who are all kind of inbred freaks, kind of, or something.
Something.
And they enjoy lots of hitting people over the head with
lots
things.
Of hitting.
There's some
reference to what the chickens would be used
Well, they lived
for.
Among animals. They live among animals there, and there's no girls around.
So there you
and,
go.
Sort of things are in this family.
I'm trying to remember. Does it ever get uncomfortably graphic? I don't think the movie does.
They don't show us any
right
man on chicken action.
Right.
Well, we do see them eating some chicken at dinner once.
Yes, they do.
And the chicken is fully cooked and prepared.
And I believe one of them is sad.
I believe so, yes.
it's an oddball film, and I really enjoyed sitting through it.
Mads Mikkelsen, I like him doing funny stuff. That's fun.
Yeah.
Really loses himself in this awful character. Because apart from being kind of gross, they're also sort of mean and belligerent and also kind of smart. Like, they're science-minded. So they've got some intelligence
some
to them.
Some of them are more intelligent. But some of them are more passionate.
They're also combative and aggressive. So they're funny kinds of characters. Elias thinks that he can get the ladies, but he can't. And there's lots of talk about all that.
Goodness.
But very funny.
You haven't seen anything like it.
Every life is a miracle. It's a life-affirming.
It's an 8 out of 10 for me.
It's a B. Okay, next is Green Room. From the writer-director of Blue Ruin, which you guys remember we loved last year, the year before, whenever that was.
We want to call this Jeremy Saulnier?
Saulnier. Jeremy Saulnier.
Saulnier. Saulnier.
I don't know if he pronounces it the French way or not, but that's him, and this is his next movie, also with a color in the title.
Yep.
Green Room, and it concerns a punk band driving around in their van.
They got a gig.
Siphoning gas. You know, punk band. You know how the punk bands are.
They're just getting by.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe they're hardcore.
I think they're hardcore. Yeah, they are hardcore.
Thing, maybe. Yeah, yeah.
Yep, that's anyway, how they choose to live.
And they wind up getting a gig gets canceled. They get a consolation gig for a bar out in the boonies of the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
And
they don't know if it's going to be okay or not that they're playing there because these people are even harder core than hardcore.
Because, well, they're Nazis.
Right.
They're Nazi skinheads. Keep it down. We're trying to do a show over here.
Unbelievable.
Nazi skinheads. And so they're playing at the Nazi skinhead bar. They are not on board with that.
No.
But, you know, a gig's a gig.
Yep.
And so they're going to do the show. They're going to get out of there. But then there's trouble.
They see something they shouldn't.
See something that the people who did it wish they hadn't.
So then the neo-Nazis...
Back in the green room, which
neo-Nazis
is where
you hang out
before
around,
the show, the green room, yeah.
And they want to figure this problem out on their terms, not on the old punk band's terms.
Our people, we got Anton Yelchin.
Anton Yelchin is one of my favorite young actors, I'm realizing.
I like him. Aliyah Shawkat, Imogen Poots, some other guy.
Eric, I want to commend you on not
saying
laughing.
Imogen Poots without giggling?
Yeah.
I'm over that now. I'm in my 40s.
Huh.
Yeah. It becomes a sort of a siege thriller where they've kind of barricaded themselves in the green room, and then the owner of the bar, who is not just the owner, he does also happen to be a neo-Nazi, not a skinhead.
No.
Neo-Nazi, anyway.
Yeah, neo-Nazi.
And it's Patrick Stewart.
The
Sir Patrick Stewart.
Uh-huh.
He's the boss here.
So he engages the punk band to try to get this situation resolved.
Let's get it settled. I don't want to just settle down here.
All right, so you
nobody else needs to get hurt.
I was referring to The Martian as being a dramatic science porn. Mm-hmm. Green Room to me is like authentic action porn.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you so nervous and feels like this is how bad knives and guns and violence can be.
It's interesting how much it plays up the tension of violence and the threat of violence, and it does it all with very minimal amount of actual weapons. It's basically one gun is what the movie comes down to. Which is an interesting, refreshing change.
Completely.
To not be overwhelmed with guns and knives. They're in the green room. They're trying to escape. There's some graphic injuries.
Oh, my goodness.
Some graphic injuries are sustained.
If you are squeamish for the violence, there are some moments here that you will not enjoy.
And I kept thinking, I don't know about you, but I kept thinking that I kept being surprised at where the movie went geographically.
Completely.
I sort of got used to it being in the green room, and then they manage to get out, and they go some other place, and they find some ways to vary it up to keep the story going. And we get a few mild surprises with people's motivations and stuff. And
right, we get variances there, and then we also, like, from the neo-Nazis, is like, all right, let's try this.
Right.
All right, let's try this.
Yeah. I have to say, as much as I love Patrick Stewart, and everyone loves Patrick Stewart, of course, I don't feel like he loses himself in this role. And part of it may not be his fault. His voice is so distinctive that even when he's not doing, even when he's doing a kind of an American accent, he still sounds too Patrick Stewart-y.
And not only that, while this is the, you know, kind of maybe worst character that we've seen him play, he's still fairly stoic.
Mm-hmm.
There's never... he's not reckless with this character at all. And I think it works for the movie.
He's a smart businessman, yeah.
Right.
He's got to run
this
club.
I think it works for the movie,
but
it's almost like we needed one yelling and screaming Patrick Stewart
scene.
We need to see
him meaner.
Yeah. We needed one moment where it was like, I now am afraid of Patrick Stewart.
Which I think they realize because near the end they have him drop the N-word. Like, yeah. I think just to remind us that, oh, yeah, he is a neo-Nazi
That's
bad
right.
guy. That's right. Yeah, he is an
I'm not
man.
Supposed to be rooting for
right,
him.
Right, yeah. But very, very suspenseful, intense, and, like we said, kind of graphic sometimes.
Yeah.
Everyone loved this movie. This might be sort of the overall consensus favorite of the festival.
I believe so. I'm not hearing anybody, like, complain about the film.
Everyone really seemed to like this. We both liked it a lot, and you'll be able to see it in the spring, I think it's going to come out.
So here's the thing. If you haven't seen Blue Ruin yet, see Blue Ruin.
Go do that.
And then I'm actually going to see Murder Party because I have not seen
it
yet.
That's
his first film. But yeah, I'm looking forward to my next viewing. I can't wait to see how this unfolds once I know the story.
Mm-hmm.
If it's just like a technical marvel next time around
and
playing the beats or what.
The other thing is it's only 94 minutes and I kept feeling like it was longer.
Because,
in a good way. Because so much kept going on.
Because you really feel like kind of stuck.
Yeah.
And you're like, I don't know what we're going to do, punk band. I don't know.
Anton Yelchin's in charge of us.
Yeah.
He's kind of a wimp. What are we going to do?
Look how scared he is.
Yeah, it's B+.
9 out of 10.
Man, we like everything.
April.
April. And
The Extraordinary World.
This is an animated film from, is it France? I know it's in the French language.
Yes. Well, I think Belgium and Canada helped out a little
They're
bit,
They're all
too.
Sort of involved there. The Belgians, the Canadians,
French. You know the types.
Sure. Based on, I'm sure, a graphic novel, like everything is.
Probably,
I have to warn you up front, this was the movie that I slept through.
Oh.
Slept through a good chunk of it. Every festival, there's a movie at some point where you hit the wall, and even though you're enjoying the film and you want to see it, you just fall asleep. You have not had this problem, and you're the anomaly. You're the anomalisa.
But do you know why I am?
Why?
Because I rarely do midnight. That is the reason, I think.
Yeah, maybe.
I think that's probably the reason.
Could be. And you're an early riser anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And I dislike naps. You put it all together.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I liked this, but I can't in good conscience really write a review
of it.
It's
really, really simple.
It's
okay.
It's delightful.
1870s.
Mm-hmm.
What if steam technology is the farthest we advance.
Something happened, alternate timeline, and so where it's steampunk.
Yep.
And so then it gets to be the 30s, and we don't, and there's no gasoline and
right.
other stuff, so it's all airships and steampunk. Raffy. Hey, Raffy. Cameo by Raffy.
He said his own name.
Yeah, I know. Like Pikachu.
So what happens is then, not only that, some scientists are getting plucked.
Scientists disappearing.
Disappearing.
Sort of like that movie Tomorrowland.
Yep.
This is like what if Tomorrowland had been a good movie.
That's right. Exactly.
This. Yeah, so all the scientists are getting plucked, and so that's why new discoveries aren't happening. And there's a little girl named April.
That's right.
Voice of Marianne Cotillard.
Lovely.
And she is an adventure.
There's an adventure, and it's about the ultimate serum.
It's this invincibility serum.
Right, because this could change the path of things. Oh, and by the way, the cat talks.
She has a talking cat, which I believe is the result of some previous scientific experimenting or something.
It all works. It all feels lovely.
Why does the cat have carefully drawn balls and anus, would you say? We see the cat's balls
and anus. I believe that's
anus.
The Belgian... in the film.
It seemed like an odd choice to make sure you draw the cat's balls.
It's authentic.
I guess.
Here's the thing about this film. It is 90 minutes long, and it's a wonderful adventure. Somehow, and I've talked to a few others that feel the same way, somehow it needed a little bit more energy, which is weird for all the whimsy that it has in it.
Right,
So yeah. So that's the one complaint about it. It's a 7 out of 10.
It's, I'm sure, perfectly fine. What I saw of it, I enjoyed very much. I look forward to seeing it completely again. Anything else you want to say? You want to say your name again?
I love you guys, and this is the best podcast in the world. So, guys, everyone,
I really just wanted you to say your name again.
Raffy.
Pod bomb.
Pod bomb.
Oh, man.
All right. What did you say? 7 out of 10?
7.
All right. Love, Milla.
Love, Milla.
From Finland.
Here was my first sentence. Hmm. They are wacky.
They sure are. It's basically a fairly, at its heart, a fairly ordinary relationship story, romantic comedy kind of a situation, set in a world that is much like our own world, except there are weird things. Like, for example, the first one, is it her? It's Milla's parents, right?
Yes.
Milla's parents are zombies. But it turns out they're not zombies, they're just drunk. In this world, when you drink, you turn into a zombie.
Uh-huh.
Which I find endlessly amusing.
Yes. It plays on some lovely things here to where it's like everything that occurs, it's like, well, I guess that's technically not far from the truth.
Right.
Like,
there's,
you know,
zombies,
what I mean? There's a hint of something in everything.
But it's not a zombie movie. That's just one detail. Milla's got a friend who is a superhero. That's her job.
Uh-huh.
And she can't fly very well. She's always... And so the Superman guy is always getting there before her. But that's her job. She's a superhero.
Yeah.
That's just a thing.
I think isn't there time travel?
There's time travel, like, as a tourist thing.
Right.
You can go visit the future.
Yeah. Heads explode on occasion, but it's not what you think.
That's right. Heads explode. When you make out, when you get sexually passionate,
and,
your heads explode.
There's you can buy black market strong arms.
That's right, like bionic arms.
And there's a giant panda that needs to be restrained.
I don't know what the panda was all about.
Here's
the
thing.
There are many, many very quirky, odd, random details. Our friend Vince Mancini said that it's like a feature-length Fantastic Fest bumper.
Yeah.
In a good way. It's like you think of the sorts of elements that you like in a lot of these genre movies, zombies and time travel and whatever else.
Right.
And kind of put them all together into one world. Not for any cohesive... reason. It's not like, here's a movie set in the world of movies, or in the world of sci-fi. It's just the world, and none of those things really factor much into the actual story. They're just sort of details in the periphery. And it makes it, I thought it was a very funny, very funnily written movie. A lot of the dialogue made me laugh, like good jokes.
Right.
Even apart from the other silly stuff.
Remember how there was somebody who was just infecting people with a flu?
Yes.
By like wiping their hand on stuff.
Yeah.
And there was detectives trying
to
solve the case.
Trying to find out who was
spreading
the flu.
But they weren't detectives, they were just people.
Yeah. And somebody, a woman got tired of breastfeeding, so she's got a thing for her husband to breastfeed instead.
Oh.
Very enjoyably random and odd movie. It ran out of steam for me in the second half.
It ran out of steam for me in the second half.
But I still absolutely enjoyed it.
It's 7 out of 10 for me.
Yeah. B. Next up. High Rise. This is one of my more anticipated films because it was directed by Ben Wheatley.
Ben Wheatley, who I loved because of Sightseers, liked because of Kill List.
Because Kill List is so great.
And on the other hand, Field in England did not do it for me.
Didn't do for me. I forget, did you ever see his first one?
Yeah, I think it's like a 6 out of 10.
Down Terrace.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that as well. Yeah, so now High Rise is based on a book by J.G. Ballard, and it's set in the near future or whatever. And the gist of it, we've got Tom Hiddleston, who is narrating for us. He's a doctor, and he moves into a new apartment in this High Rise. The High Rise is meant to be, it's a complex of High Rises. Each meant to be its own little independent city.
Yes.
It's got grocery stores and swimming pools and whatever else you need there in the building.
And, the lower class are low and the higher class are high.
Yeah. And then it becomes an issue of resources. The higher class is getting, the water and electricity. The things that you would expect in this story of the disintegration of society. But the very odd thing about the movie, and presumably the book, is that the details of how society goes from working okay to falling into chaos and turning into Snowpiercer.
Yes.
Those details are omitted, are skipped over.
Yep.
It just sort of, now it's chaos. Oh, now there's a little bit more chaos. And it is a very, very odd choice to tell the story that way.
It's
very off-putting.
It feels like, it almost feels like a political choice. Like Ben Wheatley is saying something about society.
Like what?
Well, no. I don't know. I think he knows. But I mean,
I think it may also.
But
be
it's
the book
one of
too.
Those. Yeah, but it's one of those things where it just it rings like that. As opposed to being on a journey,
right?
You're supposed to be getting a vibe of something.
It is a very bizarre. It's a class metaphor, but it's a very bizarre class metaphor. I wonder if there may be some specifically English things in it. In the end, it comes around to being very specifically, it's set in the 70s, and so it's Margaret Thatcher, and we hear her voice on the radio. It becomes very specifically about England.
Yeah.
And the last thing we see is a bubble bursting.
Get it?
So I wonder if there's some that culturally I don't appreciate. I like the movie, but I want to see it again because I think that it will click better for me. And I realized it's been the case. It was the case with Kill List and it was the case with Sightseers. I liked them both better after I saw them a second time. It came together better for me.
Okay. Sightseers, I was good with the first time.
Yeah, and I liked Kill List the first time. I liked it even more.
Okay.
Things that hadn't made sense made better sense to me.
To me, this movie felt like... what the heck was that movie with Scarlett Johansson?
Under the Skin?
Under the Skin. It felt like Under the Skin.
This isn't that only, inscrutable, though.
No. Only in the reception of it all. In people proclaiming their love for it, but not being able to say anything beyond that.
Yeah.
That I've had many conversations with people like, what? You didn't like High Rise? And they can't verbally continue from that thought to try to show me
what
it
they
was
liked
something
about it, yeah.
That... but there's something there.
Something's there.
So I might sit through it again.
I want to see it again.
I might.
Because I did enjoy it. It's not like I didn't enjoy the experience of watching it.
I don't know.
It just
I don't
didn't
think
quite
I
all
did.
Come together for me. Tom Hiddleston was really good. Also, Luke Evans is a fellow who's also sort of having a breakdown. We meet the architect of the buildings. It's Jeremy Irons. That figures in. I withhold a grade at this point because I want to see it again.
My hunch is it'll maybe go from a 5 to a 6 if I see it again. We'll find out.
So we'll come back to High Rise. That will open... When is it going to open?
2016. In the future, I believe.
In the future.
Yep.
Next up, Der Bunker.
Der Bunker.
Which is German for The Bunker.
I get it.
Yeah. It's a German film set in a bunker.
And
the description of this in the Fantastic Fest book does not accurately describe the sort of movie that it is. It makes you think of a different kind of movie entirely.
All right, this is the movie.
Mm-hmm.
A student, college student or something. Student or a professor, actually. No, he's a professor.
He's working on
some mathematics.
Yeah.
Some formula to solve everything.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks he's got something and he needs a quiet place to do his research. So he rents a room from a house which has a husband and wife and a child. Mm-hmm. And the child,
He's like 8 years old.
But looks like a man.
30 maybe, yeah.
At least definitely his face.
Definitely he's an adult, but he
His face is adult.
It's an adult.
His body might
be a
little
yeah.
smaller.
And they live, this house is a converted military bunker.
Right.
And he's renting a room in this bunker.
Yeah. And it's quirky.
They ask him if he'll help pay the rent, if he'll do some tutoring for their son.
Uh-huh.
And that's a little weird.
Yeah.
Oof. And it there's also, they make reference to Klaus is the kid.
Yeah.
And the student, we never learned the student's name. They just call him the student.
Right.
The dad encourages the student to go ahead and beat Klaus with the cane, if need be.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, a lot of these details make it sound like a horror movie. But it's not a horror movie.
It's definitely
not a horror movie. We're keeping you prisoner in this bunker. We're going to force you to do terrible things. It's not that way you think it's going to be. There's also reference to someone named Heinrich.
But what is it?
It's a dark comedy with supernatural horror elements. It has elements of supernatural horror.
Okay.
Through Heinrich, who is another person or being who is referenced and whose opinion matters, who mother and father want to talk to. And there's a thing that talks that you wouldn't expect to talk.
Yeah.
I enjoy that. I get a big kick out of that. I like it when things talk that aren't supposed to talk. Like Weinberg. I enjoy this weird, sometimes funny movie. I enjoy the weirdness of it.
I don't think anybody needs to see this movie.
But I don't blame anyone for not enjoying it if they don't enjoy it.
Yeah.
I think you didn't enjoy it.
I actually end up feeling very average about it because I did like some things about it.
Yeah.
But when it all coalesced in the end, I was just like, all right, next. I want to be done thinking about Der Bunker.
I will say I'm glad that I watched it on a screener before the festival because I think I would have felt like, oh, I should have seen something else in that slot.
Yeah.
If I'd seen it here.
Yeah.
But I did overall enjoy it. Der Bunker. I give it a B-.
I give it a 5.
Next up, Hard to Get.
Hard to Get.
From the nation of South Africa.
South Africa.
It's one of those movies. It's a formula action movie
where
you got a guy who fools around with the hot girlfriend of a gangster, runs afoul of the gangster, and now he, this guy, his name's TK.
TK.
He and the girl, Mugza. Skeets. Skeets is the girl. They go and do some crimes together, and
he constantly he's a ladies' man, but he thinks she's in a different category.
Yeah,
and she is. She gorgeous to look at.
She's
this woman.
And he is a ladies' man. The movie plays that up a lot.
Yeah.
He's also though as like the hero of the movie. A few times I wasn't sure how seriously we're supposed to take him because a couple times he's like kind of bumbling and screws things up a little bit.
Yeah,
and I wasn't sure like is that supposed to be like when Indiana Jones.
No, I think
his whip or whatever.
I think
it
was mainly supposed to be the idea of this is his first time because everything that he's doing to try to impress her. She's constantly egging him on,
but he is also usually very smooth.
With the ladies, not with the crime. And that's supposed to be the fun of this. There's some good looking stuff here, and it's formulaic, and it passes the time.
It's a six. Yeah, it's a C plus.
Yeah.
Next, The Witch.
The Witch.
The Witch premiered at Sundance. Oh, we won't burden you again with the tales of trying to see this movie at Sundance.
I didn't try to see this movie at Sundance.
I tried, and I got shut out of one press screening, and then another one. Oh. I guess I will burden you with the
tales.
Yeah,
you just did.
I just did. I'm sorry.
Aww.
Anyway, so I was glad to finally be able to see it here at the Draft House, which, as I realized, is the best place to see it anyway, because The Witch is mostly a quiet movie. One of those thrillers, one of those scary kind of movies that's very quiet.
Yeah. Until it's not.
But it has many quiet parts, and I like seeing movies like that at places where you can count on the audience to also be quiet.
There's no better place in the world.
Not going to hear whispering or see people texting or whatever. Anyway, The Witch, it's old England, New England Puritans, 1600s.
Mm-hmm.
Little Puritan family, exiled, living out by themselves. Mom and a dad and a teenage daughter and a son and a couple of twins.
Yeah.
And they speak in very authentic, old-timey Puritan 1600s language, which I I figured they would because I knew the time period was set. I didn't realize that they were how realistic they were going to go. They didn't just throw in some these and thous. Like, this is full on.
Everything feels tremendously correct.
Yeah,
with the time period
and their
the look of the film, everything about it.
They start to have
the time period.
There's a baby. They have a baby, Samuel, and then there's a tragedy with the baby, and then there are some weird things happening. Like out in the woods near the house, maybe in the house, maybe there's something. Well, the movie's called The Witch.
Yeah.
So dark things begin to happen.
And then sometimes not much happens.
Mm-hmm. But while not much is happening, it's boiling and it's becoming... It really did feel to me like an oppressive... The atmosphere was oppressive. That even when there was, quote unquote, nothing happening,
yeah,
that something was happening, that the situation, the water was getting slightly hotter, coming to a boil. I felt it. I was into it. But it's not the kind of movie that is scary in the way of it's going to give you nightmares or that it's like a constant.
Oh goodness,
or even
no.
A frequent thrill ride. It is a different kind of scary movie.
Right.
From that, and I think that's important to know.
And not only that, it's told. I guess. Let's see. There isn't. I don't think there's much wiggle room with this story. It's offering a folk tale, but it's mm-hmm. doing it in an authentic way. So it
right.
like yes, and like there, you know, it is called The Witch,
right?
And it is a story that they would have passed around.
Sure.
During that time. Why would they have told this story? This particular story. Why is that? This is not. This is one of my things with it that I was curious about. It doesn't feel like it's good versus evil.
Right.
It doesn't feel like it's believers versus non-believers. Although it's definitely religion is touched upon quite a bit in the film.
I think it's meant to be indicative of the sort of thing that happened back in this time when this is, you know, before the Salem witch trials, or but when witches were a thing, or people were afraid of witches anyway. And so I think this is meant to be the sort of thing where that would happen often, where a family's like, is there a witch in our midst? Is
yeah.
one of us a witch?
Explain the hard to explain.
Yeah.
That's
is
what
there,
this...
Is right. there maybe no such thing as witches, but we're all paranoid mm-hmm. about who might be the witch? And I think, it plays well into that of, we have the father who is a devout religious man, who even at one point starts to think, maybe I'm the problem here. Maybe I have done
right.
something wrong. And they all go through that of, is it me? Is it you? Is it her and him? And always coming back to this religious repression of being sort of tamped down. The boy has lustful feelings for his sister a little
mm-hmm.
bit. And he thinks, well, maybe that's it. And all these things of how we will, yeah, and how in those days they would have used unexplained phenomenon to
right.
use that. No, what am I trying to say? Use their, oh, I sinned, that's why this thing happened. Or I'm not right with God, that's why these things are happening.
But maybe that's not why those things
but
happen.
But maybe it's not. Exactly. Maybe it's all on our heads. Maybe it's not.
Or maybe it's not.
Or and maybe I don't, it is.
But I don't think this movie... I don't think this movie touches on that for me because it states what it is throughout the film. Like, it states what it is. It doesn't leave it open-ended to question or wonder.
Eventually it doesn't, but along the way.
Along the way it kind of sort of does, but not really.
It could all... There doesn't seem to be any question of whether there's an evil force involved
right.
here. The question is who or what is bringing it, I suppose.
Yeah, and
yeah.
I found this movie technically engaging, and the story was boring for me. And I know that I'm kind of alone on this.
Oh, you're not kind of alone.
I'm completely alone.
You're alone like Matt Damon on Mars.
Like, I enjoyed all of the effort
yeah.
and accuracy that this movie holds, and therefore it's a 6 out of 10 for me.
But B+.
I did not enjoy the story.
I liked it very much. Very, very much.
It's an intense musical score.
Mm, it is very intense.
Yeah.
Then there's a movie called Dangerous Men. This was a secret screening here at Fantastic Fest, and they told us ahead of time that it would be the sort of secret screening. Sometimes the secret screenings are a new film, like they showed Crimson Peak. Other times, it's an old film they've discovered that they want to spring on us, and this was the latter case. And the Draft House is going to distribute this film in the fall, so you all will be able to see it. And it's called Dangerous Men. It was the life work of an Iranian man named John Rad.
John Rad.
Came to America, spent 20 years making this movie. 20 years making a movie that is even more incompetent than the movies that Roger Corman used to crank out in 3 days. Like, yeah. It's amazing that it took 20 years to make such an inept movie.
It's amazing that this was his passion.
Right. And we got to see the movie, and you'll get to see it. It'll be on video on demand, and it'll be in some theaters, too, later in the fall. We'll keep you apprised, because you absolutely should see this movie. It is.
Here's the key. Hmm. Just like with Roar, you have to see it with at least one other individual.
You want
to
see
so
it in
can,
oh,
you can
sure. You want
to
see
turn
it in the group?
To somebody and be like, what the heck are we watching?
Yeah. Basically, every way the movie could be bad, it is bad. It's an action movie, I guess, about a woman getting revenge on her fiancé's killers, kind of. And
I actually,
some other things.
Here's the most amazing part of Dangerous Men. Hmm. I think it's really close to being, like, especially for its time period, one of the best feminist films I've seen. But it goes overboard.
What do you
it.
Think its time period is?
What do you want to call it? Should
it was
we call
made,
it 80s?
He started in 85. He finished it and played it in theaters in 2005.
I think we should say 80s.
All right. it's women getting revenge, but there were a ton of those in the 70s, too.
Especially. No. But the way that this is done, it's honoring the woman more than most of those films do, I think.
I don't think that's true.
I think it is
I
true.
I disagree with you.
Not a,
on
like
that.
Here's the thing. It's not a good movie.
No,
I'm
it's
not
a terrible
that.
Movie.
But anyway.
It's very, very fun to watch.
Yes.
You will enjoy
it's amazing.
It. Amazing. Next up, The Devil's Candy. Which, do you know what The Devil's Candy is? Tootsie Rolls. Because it's the bastard cousin of chocolate.
See, I would have actually said...
You think you're getting something good, but no, it's a Tootsie Roll.
Swedish Fish.
Those are bad, too, but those...
Stuck in your teeth.
Yeah, yeah.
I hate that candy.
The Devil's Candy, written and directed by Sean Byrne, who made a film called The Loved Ones several years ago that had played at South by Southwest and then disappeared for a while. It became one of those fabled films that couldn't get released.
Do you like heavy metal?
I don't.
I don't either.
Particularly.
But guess what? This movie has a lot of it.
It does.
And I was able to accept it and move through it.
Because we got a guy, a crazy guy. Pruitt Taylor Vince is the actor. And he always plays crazy guys because that thing he does can do with his eyes.
I don't know if he can do it or he does do
it. We were discussing this with a mutual friend who actually worked on this film.
Oh.
Who said that he's pretty sure he can do it or not do it.
Oh.
It's a thing that he can do, but he's not doing it like all the time.
Oh, good for him. I was worried for his sake that it would be something he'd be stuck doing always.
Crazy-eyed guy, and he plays heavy metal music loud to drown out the voices.
Oh, yes.
And
the voices make him do terrible things.
Sure.
This is,
you know, like
this is mean stuff.
I
want to
see one where someone
here.
Hears voices that makes him like go out and like rake people's leaves. Or shovel the snow.
The voices made me do it. It
made me commit acts of kindness.
Oh, that's nice.
But Ethan Embry and his wife, Shiri Appleby, and I guess they have a daughter, right?
Of course they have a daughter.
Move into a house, and it's the house where a crazy guy recently killed his parents.
That's right.
And so is it a spooky house? I don't know. Because Ethan Embry starts hearing some voices, too.
That's right.
And
how is it all connected? We don't know.
Crazy guy comes back to the house, and that can't be good.
No, it's not good. And
they want him around.
More mean things happen.
Yeah.
This is a movie that Ethan Embry really throws himself into this performance.
He's a tortured artist.
Tortured artist.
Plays the heavy metal
tatted
music.
Up,
also, he
very
paints,
cut.
But he the voices become his muse. He becomes like a good artist. And so it's also a Faust deal with the devil kind of thing. Like, oh, do I need to sell my soul to be able to be a good painter?
And
that's involved.
And it actually puts some energy and drama into the idea of picking your kid up from school and how important that can be. but like, all in all, a horror movie that I normally feel like falls into the category of bad taste.
Yeah.
Because it's trying to be so mean.
Right.
This one finds the balance of being really mean, but not necessarily in bad taste.
I don't feel like it's that mean. I know what you mean by that, but it didn't
like,
feel
like with the voice, with the music, with the actual killings.
Yeah.
It won't let up.
Yeah.
This is the devil.
Relentless. Yeah.
Like that.
Exactly,
that's what I meant.
Exactly like that. Yes,
that's what I meant.
And
I liked it.
I liked it. Okay. I have no strong feelings on this particular one.
I'm impressed that I like it upwards of getting it at a 7. So it's like good for that movie that I normally wouldn't care for.
Yeah, B minus.
Getting a 7 out of me.
For me, it's all right. February. Written and directed by one Oz Perkins. And this stars people we know. Or people we know of, anyway. I guess we don't know them personally.
No, I don't know them.
Emma Roberts. Kiernan Shipka, who played Sally Draper on Mad Men.
Mm-hmm.
And then, who's the other one? Oh, the other one we don't know.
Right.
It's at a Catholic girls' school. Rose is the other one's name. Lucy Boynton. Rose, bad girl, maybe pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
They're coming up on a break. Parents are going to come, and then it's going to be a week break.
Catherine, a little emotionally disturbed.
Little kind cat. Kiernan Shipka.
She's a little worried that her parents might have had an accident on the way to
mm-hmm.
get her.
Mm-hmm. And then also, meanwhile, or something, Joan, the Emma Roberts character, is on her way to the school. She hitches a ride with
that's right.
with some parents. And there's some question of maybe someone at this Catholic girls' school has been diddling with the devil.
Right.
Some satanic influences. There's rumors about some of the nuns were worshiping Satan in the basement, as nuns do.
It's a slow burn, and I'm really engaged with the first third of this film. But then there's it's pretty much like, I feel like the director showed her hand.
Mm-hmm. His.
His hand. And just did it too quick. And then, for me, the most boring things kept happening from these reveals.
We realize that the story is not being told in a linear, chronological fashion, mm-hmm. necessarily. And you can't talk about all the issues with it without spoiling it.
No,
but the way that it all comes together in the end, some aspects of it feel like a cheat. The extent to which it makes sense
most
is
aspects,
a cheat.
Yes.
And then the other parts just don't make sense. It's either you don't get it or you get it, but oh well, that's a cheat then.
Yeah, you cheated.
It's sort of unsatisfying.
And then not only
way.
That, it was kind of weird. There was a few attempted scares that visually just fell flat for me. As far as there was some that worked, because like some of this is pretty bloody.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
But there was others like contortion sort of things where I was just like, it just didn't fit. It didn't fit. It feels out of place, and it just looks weird.
I'm definitely on board with Sally Draper maybe being possessed by the devil.
Excuse yeah, that I don't mind that idea.
I assume this is a sequel to Mad Men. This is what happened to her.
It might be. We don't know.
But it winds up being a misfire. C.
Yep. 5 out of 10.
Next up, Schneider versus Bax. Not Snyder. Schneider.
That's right.
Different people. I had nothing to do with this.
Eric D. Schneider.
Schneider versus Bax comes from Dutch. The Dutch Land. Made by Alex von Vormerdam, who made Borgman a couple years ago, which I adored, and you didn't.
I did not.
Many people did not. This is not like that.
Not at all.
This is.
It is, in this way, it is a deliberately paced film again. So this is a professional hitman has a job,
mm-hmm.
but there's some classic double-crossing. And there's another professional hitman involved.
Basically, two hitmen have been assigned to kill each other.
That's right.
Is what it comes down to. And it plays out. It's out. It's very minimalist. Very minimalist. It's mostly set up. Cartoon. Looney Tunes means cartoon. Right. Here's these creatures. I mean, almost a roadrunner. Step morally balanced.
Right.
Match. Thing of. They keep going back and forth, kill each other, and other people get involved, get dragged into it.
And it's definitely not fast paced.
No,
but it's
kind of funny,
and kind of addictive. Like it's one of those movies where it's like, all right, I'm not necessarily loving the process, but I gotta know where this is going.
Yeah,
like who's gonna win? How's this gonna end? That sort of thing, and it is.
There's no grand plans. No,
no.
It really is this One of the repeating the scenario of just taking turns trying to kill each other.
One of the hitmen has a daughter who's not in a good space right now.
And his father comes over, and grandpa's a weird guy, too.
Really weird guy.
Commandeers a prostitute to help him out, be an accomplice.
Yeah. I guess I liked the location more than anything.
It's an odd, mirthful contract-killing film. Not much to it. No real point or message or anything. Just a fun little exercise.
Yeah. It's okay.
It's okay. It's a B-.
Yep. It's a 6.
Too Late.
Oh, Too Late.
The last film that we both saw that we're going to talk about here. Dennis Houck is the writer-director. And this is an ambitious film.
To say the least.
Does a couple of interesting things. The first thing that it is this guy saw Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown. I'm gonna guess a lot. I'm gonna guess he's seen the Tarantino's many times.
Yes.
And so what this is a Tarantino-ish sort of movie, told out of sequence, and the gimmick of it, which I think is very interesting.
It's fascinating to watch, I think.
Is that the movie is 5 reels long. Each reel is about 20 minutes. And each reel, and it was shown, we saw it in 35 millimeters, we saw the reel changes. Each reel is one continuous take.
There are 5 scenes in this movie.
5 scenes, each one lasting exactly 1 reel, which also means it would be very easy to show the reels in the wrong order, and you wouldn't know. Because it's even in the right order, the story is out of sequence.
Right, that is true.
And so you wouldn't really know which way is the right way out of order. It concerns John Hawks as a private detective in L.A. who is contacted by a girl he had some contact with a few years ago.
Yeah.
She ends up dead, and then
it's a mystery of it all. A
mystery of who killed
it's
her and why.
It's a private dick trying to solve it. And it's definitely film noir. Mm-hmm. It is, like, the way that they talk.
Hawks is funny. He's funny, wisecracking P.I. character. Robert Forster turns up at the owner of a strip club. The murder victim was a stripper there. So we get into that. We go back to when they first met, and we back and forth in time a little. Like I said, five.
Some
I think the
incredibly attractive women giving great performances too. Mm-hmm. I think that are totally engaging.
Sure.
Of which I didn't recognize them.
The issue in the first scene is a couple of drug dealers who talk, just doing some banter.
And their banter's weak.
Their banter is terrible. It's like someone doing a parody of Bad Tarantino.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is a Forest Park Ranger character who comes on. Again, this is all just in that first act. And he is one of the most irritating characters I've seen in a while. Because he's overwritten, folksy.
He's folksy and noir somehow.
Folksy and noir and self-aware and Tarantino and pop culture references. And just terrible, and I hated him. And it's funny how widespread this feeling is. I've seen several people on Twitter say that they almost walked out in the first 15 minutes because it is kind of insufferable.
It was one of the times where you've actually given me something.
I warned you.
You warned me, and it was good that you warned me because to me, it played like I was supposed to know somebody was making a movie. Do you know what I mean? Like, it played false, so utterly and unbelievably false. But then, as soon as John Hawks becomes front and center...
And once they get rid of those other characters,
it is
a lot better.
I think it's fantastic. I am so engrossed with this movie after the start.
It's really a terrific story, and telling it out of order makes it fun. And it's interesting how you could almost tell it in any sequence, I think, and it would
I think
be
you could,
about
there might be,
the same.
Well, there'd be an...
you'd figure...
It depends how you're left emotionally.
Right,
because each one does have a different emotional thing. But yeah, like, I think it actually would be something that I would want to see in chronological order at some point and, like, see how it plays. And it is... John Hawks, I loved his performance. It's one of my favorite performances of this year for me. Like, it was just... It was a work of art. It is.
Even after that first act, now and then the dialogue gets too cute for me and too
not for me.
Self-aware.
But
the sort of insufferable Tarantino thing. But overall, I really, really, really enjoy it. I also have an issue with what turned out to be the central thing that happened.
The
plausibility
okay.
of that. I don't really buy it, but I'll go with it. So yeah, overall, I am in the positive, very positive. I give it a B+.
Yeah, I'm an 8 out of 10 on this one.
And this clearly a very talented filmmaker.
Yeah, I'm going to keep an eye on this guy.
And with maybe a better script, he'd be even better. All right, so those are all the Fantastic Fest movies that we both saw. And now we'll quickly go over the ones that only one of us saw. Just to give you a little heads up on what you might want to look for. You got one?
I got one. The Lobster.
The Lobster. This is the only thing that I really wanted to see that I couldn't see here.
Do you know how to say this director's name? He's
the
guy behind Dogtooth, which people have seen, but I haven't.
Yeah, I don't know if you'd like Dogtooth or not.
I don't either. But anyway,
I liked it.
I like this.
Lobster.
This is, of course, the tale that we all grew up hearing, which is if you end up separated from a marriage, then you can go to this hotel, and you have 45 days to find true love. Otherwise, you'll be turned into the animal of your choice.
So you do get to choose the animal that you'll turn into.
That's right.
All right. Well, that's fair.
It is...
I would be a dog.
I can't wait for you to see the movie. It is wholly original. It feels wonderfully... like there is a
microscope
put on us as far as like what it truly means and how we truly feel to be in a relationship, in being single, what all this plays in, and it's just is such a lovely balance of that. And it's Colin Farrell, John C. Reilly, and the narration by Rachel Weisz, purposeful narration. I was hooked from beginning to end. Some people didn't love the third act. I'm looking forward to seeing this a second time.
All right.
The Lobster. Are we giving these scores or not?
Sure.
Nine.
Not? All right.
It's a nine.
Then I've got De Groot Zwijn. it's a Dutch film. In English, they're calling it The Great Works of G.W. Zwijn. It's an author. Zwijn, sort of a nerdy novelist in the Netherlands. Nerdy novelist of the Netherlands, and he's got money problems, and he finds a bag of money.
Oh,
you know how
doesn't it always work that way?
Always turns out just fine. So yeah, there's criminals involved, and the movie's fine. It's one of those kinds of movies where a guy who doesn't know what he's doing finds a bag of money and gets into trouble.
Yeah.
Crime thing. It's perfectly all right. It's Dutch. It's one of those, but Dutch. Nothing remarkable about it, but it's fine.
I have to whisper this next movie because the director and one of the stars has been walking around all week.
Sensoria.
It's terrible.
You did not like Sensoria.
It is one of the most egregious misuses of the jump scare and understanding when and how to present it. The visuals are so non-frightening that you almost want to think it's a joke and that you'll see a bigger picture later, but that's not the case. It's just terrible.
All right, you didn't like that. The Brand New Testament, I adored.
Mm.
The Brand New Testament.
This is one for me.
This is a French or French-Canadian. Again, they all kind of blur together. Oh, no, this is a Belgian production here. That's right, because the guy who was the voice, one of the voices in crazy Belgian cartoon with the horse and the cowboy and the... Panic, Town Called Panic.
Yes.
One of the voices in there plays God in this movie. In Brand New Testament, God is alive. He lives in Brussels. We know about his son. He's also got a daughter, 10-year-old daughter. She's been cooped up in this apartment where God and his wife live. And then she finally goes out into the world. First, though, she uses God's computer. God does all his work via computer. And God here is like this surly, not abusive, but just sort of surly and annoying. She uses computer to send a text message to everyone in the world telling them when they're going to die.
Ooh.
So now everybody has his information, which changes people's lives quite a bit.
Yes.
And she, the girl, Ia is her name, she sets out to find her own apostles. There's her dad's or her brother got 12. If she gets 6 more, then they'll have enough for a baseball game. Her mom likes baseball. Her mom is like this sort of silent, kind of putting up whatever God wants, kind of a doormat. And so we see this girl going around. The film reminds me a lot of Amelie. The way she's going around and meeting different people, and a lot of the quirky, whimsical details of people's lives.
Yeah.
And we meet these different people and see how their life is affected by knowing when they're going to die, it winds up being really... I said this before about Ben and Chicken, that it was life-affirming. I was mostly joking. The Brand New Testament actually is life-affirming, and it's daft and insane.
Is it dark?
It's got some dark stuff, but no, overall. No, overall, okay. it's a very bright, happy kind of film. Very, very enjoyable and creative and imaginative. I'm eager to see it again.
Cool.
It's definitely one of my favorites of the festival, The Brand New Testament.
Almost everything that you just said, let's just say a third of what you just said, can apply to Liza the Fox Fairy.
Liza the Fox Fairy.
Hungarian film, but it's knee-deep in Japanese lore. Mm. That's where fox fairies are supposedly from.
Sure.
And the concept here is a woman who wants nothing more than simple love. The men around her start to die.
Oh, that's too bad.
And she wonders if she's cursed.
Oh.
And there's also this, like, Japanese pop singer that's a ghost that visits her.
All right.
And it's at times so adorably cute, and at other times pretty bloody.
Yeah.
It's Amelie with a dark side. It's good. I really liked it. And it sticks the ending, which it needed to do in this movie. Like, it was just like, oh, please don't just end.
Right.
Say something. And it did.
Then I've got Son of Saul, which Son of Saul is a very good movie that didn't need to play at Fantastic Fest. It doesn't really fit. And the description of the book sort of goes out of its way to try to justify why it's playing at Fantastic Fest. It's because Tim League saw it and loved it and thought we would like it.
Yeah.
Which is fine. I think they should just say that. Rather than trying to say, you know, we don't like to define genre or whatever. Just say, yeah, we like this movie and it's good. It's set in a concentration camp. It's a camp classic.
Mmm, fun.
And Saul is one of the guys where they would have Jewish prisoners would work for the Nazis a little bit in the camp and help run things. And then eventually they'd execute them too. So it's one of these Jewish guys who's doing this terrible work. And
this sounds like homework, and I'm going to be sad and depressed.
It's pretty intense. The interesting thing about it, it's a Hungarian film, the interesting thing about the way that it's told is it's all from this guy, from Saul, from his point of view, not literally, like through his eyes, but the camera is usually like following like right behind him.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're always seeing what he sees. To the point where when the movie begins out of focus. We're out in the woods somewhere, and it's out of focus. And then he comes into the frame, and he's in focus. So, like, all we see is what is him. He's the center of it, which is interesting. It's an interesting device, the way that they tell the story. And it is intense and dramatic, and it's a good movie. I kept waiting for the Fantastic Fest part of it to kick in.
Oh.
Like... because they've got a dead body that he wants to give a proper burial to, rather than just, you know, burn it like they do. And so I kept waiting for, oh, maybe they're going to bring him back to life. Or, you know, waiting for some kind of element to
yeah.
And it's not. It's a very good Holocaust drama, just not what I wanted to see.
Okay.
Here, Son of Saul.
I saw a remake ripoff, which is a documentary all about the insanity of the Turkish cinema.
Oh, right.
Right? Yeah, and that's pretty much it. The heart of it is they watch an insane amount of movies and TV over there. An absolute insane amount.
In Turkey?
It's off the charts insane.
They eat a lot of turkey, too,
20 movies a week kind of thing.
Wow.
With that, for a long time, they had to, like, studios had to make, like, 200 movies a year. 300 movies a year. Like, actors were in, like, over 1,000 movies.
Right.
And so what they started to do was just simply see an American film and then take it. They did a lot of that. There was a lot of propaganda that was used later. And so then there was, blacklisted writers and everything to that extent. And it felt like, for a film buff... It felt like a very interesting history lesson.
I enjoy those.
That didn't come with a lot of zest and a lot of life and a lot of energy. It just felt like, oh, I'm glad I know all of this.
You know what it is? Because turkey makes you sleepy.
There you go. So, yeah, that's it.
I got Rabid Dogs, which is a remake of a 1974 film by Italian horror legend Mario Bava. His version was also released under the title Kidnapped, and it's available if you want to see it. I have seen it, and I like it. The remake is fine, sort of the classically unnecessary remake. This one is easier to see. It's in English, and the old one was sort of hard to find. But some bank robbers getting away take a couple hostages, and then they're trying to get away, and stuff happens.
Is it good? It's fine.
They've taken some of the brutality out of the remake that was in the first one.
You're pretty heartbroken.
Which can be either good or bad, but it does take some of the intensity out of it. Yeah, right. The bite. It's fine
because you see a dog.
Right. Bite. Got it. Yeah. The rabid dogs are metaphorical. There are no rabid dogs in the movie.
Well, then I won't say it.
Say up front. It's fine. It has a fun or an interesting dark conclusion.
I saw some more movies, but the only one that I really feel like talking about right now.
Yeah.
Man versus Snake.
Oh, yeah.
This is a documentary, and it is... what the heck is the name of the game again?
Nibbler.
Nibbler. And it's a video game from the 80s that not many people know. And the only reason it became interesting in the video game world, from what I understand, is it was the first game that you had the potential to score 1 billion points.
Right.
But in doing so, you would have to play this
game. Just because
game.
Of the number of digits on the
right.
on the score thing, yeah.
It's just like the oops, that's the way we set it up.
Yeah.
So the way that you play this game, you could potentially play for hours and hours. And it was something called marathon gaming, which I didn't realize it was a thing. This film has a couple of the same lovely individuals from King of Kong, Fistful of Quarters.
Another enjoyable documentary.
Which is my second favorite documentary of all time. And I was kind of skeptical on seeing this movie because I was like, it's going to cover some of the same ground, try to do the same beats, whatever
right.
the case. It's its own thing, and it is charming and hilarious. And I love watching people that are passionate about something that they otherwise shouldn't be.
Right.
Like, there's no reason to chase this goal. Chasing
right.
goals is important, but how you landed on this goal is
yeah,
a bizarre
to be the first one to score
thing.
1 billion points in this video
right.
game, yeah.
And to be overwhelmed with it, and to feel a life connection through it and sadness through it, and this movie does it all. I really liked this documentary. I give it a 9 out of 10, and keep an eye on Man vs. Snake. When you see it, you need to. And, goodness, if I haven't said it enough on the show, see King of Kong. See
King
it
Kong is a lot of fun. Yeah.
See it beforehand.
And then I got one that I'll mention called The Similars. The Similars is by a Mexican director named Isaac Isban, who last year had a film here called El Incidente, which is Spanish for The Incident.
I gotcha.
And I really enjoyed The Incident. It was a very, very cheap movie, and that hurt it, as I recall. It was one of times where the budget hurt the overall effect, but
no
the story was very enjoyable. And this is his follow-up, The Similars, and it's an homage to Twilight Zone. It's basically a Twilight Zone episode. It's in mostly black and white.
All right.
Set in a bus station, five hours outside of Mexico
one.
City.
Okay, yeah.
Some strangers are there, and some things happen. And it is very specifically Twilight Zone. It even starts with a narrator like Rod Serling saying, you know, this is the man who works at the bus station. He's worked here this long, and he doesn't know that this. And so it's very clearly Twilight Zone, and the music is very melodramatic and sweeping like that. And I got a kick out of it because the story isn't scary. It's a little suspenseful, and it's a mystery, like we're trying to figure out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then we find out what's going on, and it's funny.
Oh.
Like it's got a funny twist to it.
Interesting.
Funny ideas behind it. I just really got a kick about it as a feature-length,
cool.
fun Twilight Zone episode. The Similars. I have no idea if this was actually a world premiere here at Fantastic Fest. One of, I believe, 16 films had their world premiere here. The rest had played at other festivals. I have no idea what will become of The Similars.
All right. That's it. All right. Let's recap all of these movies.
Yeah. We're going to hold over question of the week, of course, from last week. If you could be guaranteed it would be good, what movie would you like to see remade?
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about those next week. And let's not recap all the movies.
I know, I'm kidding. The Martian. It's BS approved.
Go see that. That's the official one. That's in theaters now. The rest you'll have to wait till they come around.
Yep. But if you've learned anything, we'll remind you. But if you've learned anything, it's keep an eye out for Green Room and see his second film, Blue Ruin, if you haven't yet.
Yep, we're big supporters of Jeremy Saulnier. And so that's it. Then we've had a great time at Fantastic Fest.
What are we going to do now?
We're going to go see movies.
Going to go see movies, including more movies, Bone Tomahawk
with Kurt Russell.
And then we're going to go to a recreated ghost town and party. And you, sir, are going to party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've never stuck around for the closing night party before.
Yeah.
So by the time you hear this, that will have happened. And one or both of us may be dead. Who knows?
Tune in next week.
For Movie House with Baron Snyder, I'm Eric D. Snyder.
I am Jeff Baer.
Thanks for listening, and good day.
I said good day.
Down the hall.
Oh my gosh. We didn't even summon you.
It's a large microphone.
It's a conjuring.
We got no time. We got no time for nonsense. We got like 30 movies to get through.
All right, I want to play.
Right, no. What? No, go away. No.
Just tell them a special guest has arrived.
No.